It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about the rebuilding of the Husky Energy oil refinery in Superior and the terms of a federal settlement. The refinery has been undergoing a $400 million rebuild in the wake of major damage from that explosion and fire in April 2018 that rocked Superior and caused the widespread evacuation of the city. So what do you want to come out of this settlement? Do you feel safe living near the refinery? How important is it to the area's economy? We're at 800-642-1234. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter based in Superior, and she joins us from our studios there. Danny, welcome back.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on this morning.
So Husky Refinery would be required to make safety improvements. What is the company being asked to do under this settlement?
Yeah, sure. And it's a little bit complicated, so I'll try to explain it the best I can. But, you know, this proposed settlement is actually part of a pre-existing one that was reached between the former refinery owner, Murphy Oil, and state and federal justice officials about a decade ago in 2011. And that stemmed from Clean Air Act violations at its refineries in Superior and in Louisiana. And so they were expected to make a number of improvements to reduce emissions as a result of that. And even though Husky Energy is a relatively new owner of the refinery, they're still bound to comply with the terms of that pre-existing agreement. And so because the explosion in 2018 may have violated terms of that agreement with the emissions that were released, they are reaching this negotiated agreement as a way of releasing them from any liability from any violations of that pre-existing settlement.
I see. So this really goes back to even much before the explosion in 2018.
Yeah, so this is a change to a settlement that was reached about a decade ago. Basically, under this proposed settlement, because of the emissions that were released from the explosion, they'll have to make a number of improvements to reduce emissions in the amount of about several hundred tons because of what was released as far as pollution from the incident in 2018.
How much safer will this plant be then when it's rebuilt?
So the safety improvements that they're making as a result of the proposed settlement is exactly like the safety upgrades that they've already detailed previously last April when they announced that they were going to be rebuilding the refinery. And so a bunch of the upgrades involve their hydrofluoric acid tank, which was the reason that some city residents were evacuated during the aftermath of the explosion because of fears that that tank might spill some of that highly toxic chemical hydrogen fluoride. So some of the improvements that they're saying that they're going to make to this hydrofluoric acid tank is that they will install a rapid acid transfer system, which would essentially move any of that chemical to an emergency holding vessel in the event of a leak. They would also have enhanced leak detection with a laser detection system and some cameras, as well as some additional layers of water protection because the water vapor helps keep that chemical low to the ground if it's released into the air and keeps it from spreading.
We're talking with Danielle Kading. She's a reporter at WPR's Superior Bureau. We're looking at the terms and conditions of a federal settlement with Husky Energy following the explosion and fire in April of 2018. The refinery is currently being rebuilt. So, Danny, along with these safety improvements, the company is also agreeing to spend at least $290,000 replacing or retrofitting wood-burning stoves and furnaces in a seven-county area. What's going on there?
Yeah, so they're suggesting that under this agreement, they would replace or retrofit wood-burning stoves or furnaces and other types of inefficient wood-burning appliances at homes, churches, or schools. And they would be doing that in a seven-county area, like you said, and that would include like Douglas, Ashland, Bayfield, like all the surrounding northern Wisconsin counties and surrounding reservations, including like Red Cliff and Bad River. they would all be eligible for these types of improvements, and Husky would have to change out these inefficient wood-burning appliances at least 12% of the low-income households, or at least 12% of the money would have to be dedicated to discounts to help low-income households make those changes.
Husky is also agreeing to install 440 kilowatts of solar panels at UW-Superior. What is the thinking behind that condition?
Well, the solar panels are a way to reduce reliance on other forms of energy, from like fossil fuels. So having the solar panels, they would provide at least 440 kilowatts of power. And those would be installed, as you said, on the campus. And so that's just another way that they would be reducing or offsetting the emissions that were released from the explosion in 2018.
Danny, you're in the community a lot. Do you have any indication how Superior is feeling about this settlement as it stands now?
I really don't think a whole lot of people know about this proposed settlement right now. It's pretty new. It was just approved by the Joint Finance Committee when Attorney General Josh Call brought it to them earlier this month, and then it was only filed in court on Friday. So I don't think that a whole lot of people were aware that this settlement was even proposed.
And you talked to Mayor Jim Payne as well.
Yes. Yeah. And he was aware of the agreement. Uh-huh. He has not seen it yet himself, but he said that he trusts state and federal officials to be doing their job to have proper oversight of this company and help increase safety.
What is the timeline for the refinery to be back online to be operational?
Yeah, right now, you know, the refinery is continuing work on rebuilding. They're doing some installation of pilings right now to support foundations for equipment. They're expecting to bring that in later this spring, and they're hoping to resume full operations next year.
And so even with the refinery offline, has Husky maintained its workforce, its number of employees?
Yes. Yeah. They hire or they employ about 200 people normally. And they've had about, I think the last check, it was 350 contractors on site as well. So they have maintained the workforce during this time, even though it's not operating as it would normally.
Do we have any indication when the settlement may be finalized?
Well, I did check this morning, and it hasn't yet been taken up by the judge, or nothing's yet been filed anyway, so that remains to be seen.
And will all of the settlement safety improvements and all of the items within the settlement, will those planned upgrades be completed by the time this refinery goes back online?
It doesn't look like that. They have about 4 years to do the change-out projects with the wood stoves and furnaces. And I'm not exactly sure on the timeline that they have for installing the solar panels at
Some of the items in the settlement are not on the same timeline as getting the refinery back online.
Right. I mean, definitely with the safety improvements, those are all expected to be done as they're rebuilding the refinery.
Danny, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior, and she joined us from our studios there. Coming up, we look at the details of the merger that's in the works between T-Mobile and Sprint. It's worth more than $26 billion, a super merger. We'll learn what it means for wireless customers in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a planned merger between T-Mobile and Sprint here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So the two companies have said they'll try to close the deal as early as April 1st to create a supersized carrier with more than 100 million customers. And under the deal, Sprint will be absorbed by T-Mobile. Do you have a wireless plan with either of these carriers? What do you think about the merger? How do you feel about your current wireless plan? Are you concerned about less competition in the market? We're at 800-642-1234. Robert Siemens is an associate professor of management and organizations at New York University's Stern School of Business, and he's argued against the proposed merger alongside six other economists and antitrust experts. Rob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
So why are these two major competitors merging? What's going on here?
So the argument that that the two companies are putting forward is that they need to merge in order to save on costs, in order to build out their 5G networks to serve customers.
And T-Mobile and Sprint are trying to do this on a real fast timeline here, closing the deal by April 1st. What are some of the advantages of this proposed merger that T-Mobile is saying?
So the main advantages that they are describing would be cost savings, as well as resolving a little bit of uncertainty around being able to move forward to build out their 5G networks.
And more than 90% of Americans own a cell phone, and this merger will technically limit options for cell phone service. What implications does this have on customers?
That's right. I mean, and so that is why me, together with six other economists, have been opposed to this merger. We'd be going from four large nationwide carriers to three. So that would effectively reduce competition from four to three, or even less. Right? There are many markets where right now there aren't all four carriers present, and so we really worry that that there'll be a reduction in the number of carriers, and that will lead to less competition between the carriers, and potentially higher prices or worse quality for customers.
How would this plan expand access to cellular networks, next generation 5G? What would coverage look like with this merger?
Well, in terms of 5G, I think the first thing to realize is that there are parts of the country that currently do have 5G. Actually all four carriers do currently offer 5G in at least some parts of the country. T-Mobile has probably been the most aggressive in terms of building out their 5G offerings. And as of December, I believe they had 5G across most of their network. The issue is that they're sort of early 5G, which is what we're seeing right now. But there might be higher quality 5G, a year or a couple of years from now.
How does this deal bring in Dish Network and try to elevate Dish Network into the competition?
Yeah, this is a great point. So, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, mm-hmm. and the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, are letting the merger go through under the condition that some of Sprint's customers go to Dish Networks, and that Dish Networks builds out their own infrastructure that would then become a new fourth carrier that would then compete against what would now be the three large carriers, AT&T, Verizon, and then the combined T-Mobile Sprint.
So I was reading your brief, and it says the DOJ says that Dish's spectrum inventory is proof that it will have the ability and incentive to enter the market. First of all, explain, what is spectrum inventory?
Yeah, so spectrum are the airwaves that the carriers need in order to take data from one cell phone and pass it off to another cell phone. So over time, the carriers have bid on spectrum and have won spectrum in auctions from the FCC, or they have traded it with each other, or bought and sold it from each other or from other third parties. Over time, Dish has accumulated spectrum, but has not really used much of it to date. And so part of the thesis behind, at least part of the thesis I believe that the government has behind bringing Dish in, is that it would be an opportunity for them to use the spectrum that they have.
We're talking about the mega merger of T-Mobile and Sprint with Rob Siemens from New York University. He's an associate professor, and he filed a court brief arguing against the merger. Your questions welcome, 800-642-1234. So, Rob, why do you think Dish won't ultimately build out its network. How does this merger give Dish any added incentive here to build out, or why would it turn away from that?
Yeah, so it's I view it as sort of a strange thing, right? The argument that Sprint and T-Mobile are making to the courts in terms of why the merger should go through is that Sprint is having a hard time competing as a fourth carrier. Okay, so the government is allowing the merger to go through, but the government recognizes that it would be great to have a fourth carrier there in order to give us the benefits of competition, and so they're trying to make Dish into a fourth carrier, and so it feels like there's the two arguments are at tension with each other, right? So if you have Dish come in as a very weak fourth competitor, right, a competitor who has not been, Dish does not currently offer any type of wireless plans. They'd be starting from scratch, and to expect that they would somehow replicate what Sprint is currently doing doesn't seem to make sense to us.
Go ahead. Well, there's some indication that T-Mobile gave the FCC staff favorable data to kind of soften the blow of the competition issues raised by the merger. What was that about?
That's an interesting point. I'm actually not familiar with that.
Well, it was part of the brief saying that, you know, they wanted to show that the competition issues wouldn't be as substantial as, you know, the economists are concerned about. So another thing that was brought up in the brief is that there is this retail mobile wireless services that involves consumers, but there's also this wholesale market. What are the implications of the wholesale market on the consumer?
Yeah, and this is also a useful point to come back to the Dish point that you raised earlier. So the large carriers do provide wholesale prices, sort of wholesale access to other third parties that might want to then try to sell services to consumers. This would be the arrangement that the new T-Mobile, right, T-Mobile plus Sprint, has with Dish. Dish would get, reduced rates, wholesale rates that they would pay to Sprint, T-Mobile, and then Dish would be able to turn around and sort of sell that to customers.
Let's bring in a call now, Ruth in Madison. Hi, Ruth.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm curious, and I'm not sure whether you'll be able to answer this question, but are these two companies pushing this through so quickly before we have a chance to look at the health issues from the 5G networking? We know that there are European countries that have disallowed the 5G because of the health concerns. I'm curious what your comments are on that, and I'll take them off the air.
Ruth, thanks. Rob, are there any connections there?
Ruth, thanks for your comment. I'm not aware of any health concerns. And in fact, we do know that these carriers already are offering 5G across parts of the U.S. And so I believe that whatever health concerns there might be, the U.S. officials at least believe that we don't need to worry about them. If I could just pick up on one point that Ruth raised and Kate that you raised earlier, you both mentioned the speed with which the merger has gone through. But in fact, it actually has been a relatively slow process. So just to rewind a little bit, so T-Mobile and AT&T tried to merge back in 2011. Sprint and T-Mobile tried to merge in 2014. And then in 2018 was when Sprint and T-Mobile announced that they were going to be merging. And so the Sprint-T-Mobile merger has been in the works at least for a couple of years. It has just taken time for this to work its way through the court systems.
So as it makes its way through the courts, what would the costs be for mobile plans, and would there be a higher cost on consumers as this goes through?
So I don't think that going through the courts has any implication on costs for consumers, but the other economists and I who wrote the brief do believe that going from four national carriers to three carriers will result in higher prices for customers. Now, even if Dish ends up being a viable fourth competitor, they have 7 years to build out that network, and so that is effectively 7 years of just three national carriers.
So what needs to happen next for T-Mobile and Sprint to merge and to become one?
Great. So the merger is not yet complete. There is still a final hurdle that they have to go through, which is something called the Tunney Act proceeding. So there is a court in Washington, D.C., that is reviewing the proposed remedy whereby some of Sprint's customers would go to Dish and Dish would agree to build out its own network. So the court is reviewing that and needs to basically accept that in order for the merger, in order for the merger to be finalized.
Rob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Rob Siemens is an associate professor of management and organizations at NYU's Stern School of Business. He argued against the proposed merger alongside other economists and antitrust experts. Coming up, we look at how bail jumping charges affect people wrapped up in our state's criminal justice system. Some state Democrats have proposed legislation to change bail practices. We'll talk about it right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. The morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Violating the conditions of bail is known as bail jumping. It's becoming a lot more common in Wisconsin. From 2011 to 2018, the number of bail jumping cases in court in Wisconsin more than doubled. Defendants who jump bail intentionally fail to comply with the terms of their bond. And Representative David Crowley, a Democrat from Milwaukee, had sought to pass legislation to clamp down on what he calls the overuse of bail jumping to force plea deals. And he talked with my colleague Rob Barrett on Central Time earlier this week.
Not enough people throughout the state and many of my colleagues really understand what bail jumping is. Again, when people look at bail jumping, they look at it as, well, somebody who just didn't show up to court. But there are many conditions that a judge can set when it comes down to bail, and those conditions can be limitless.
Do you know someone who was charged with bail jumping? Was it for a misdemeanor or felony offense? How did it affect their underlying case? We're at 800-642-1234. Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Cecilia, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So as Representative Crowley said there, bail jumping isn't just about when someone doesn't show up in court when they're supposed to. When can the defendant be charged with bail jumping here in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, you certainly can be charged with bail jumping for not appearing in court when you're told to do so. But in addition, you can be charged with a count of bail jumping every time you violate any condition of your bond. And that could range from missing a curfew to missing a drug test to having contact with someone you've been told not to contact while you are pretrial.
It can also mean not drinking. There can be conditions about the number of beers you could have, for instance.
Absolutely. And typically, a no alcohol condition is fairly common, even for individuals who aren't charged with an offense that had anything to do with alcohol consumption.
So what factors might a judge take into consideration when determining the conditions for someone's bond?
In general, bond conditions should be fairly limited because a person who hasn't been convicted of a crime is presumed innocent in our legal system. That said, a lot of folks in the courts are nervous about releasing individuals to the community who are charged with crimes without putting some conditions around them that they think will ensure community safety, and certainly that they don't engage in the same kind of criminal behavior. As a result, judges have a lot of leeway legally to place as many conditions as they think are appropriate on an individual. And sometimes the conditions can really add up quickly.
And certainly even the cost of the bail could also be set very high.
Right. So when we think about releasing people to the community before they've been found guilty of a crime, there are two ways that can happen. One is that we simply release them. They sign their name and say, I agree to show up to court when I'm supposed to. We usually call that a signature bond. And they go out into the community, and they may do that without any conditions or with some. The other way that someone can be released is with cash bail. And in that case, what we say is you have to pay some money up front so that you have some skin in the game to make sure you show up to court. And then at the end of the court case, that money will be returned to you minus any fines and fees that you might owe if you're found guilty.
What factors determine whether someone receives a misdemeanor charge or a felony charge for bail jumping?
So Wisconsin has sort of an unusual process for deciding whether a violating condition of your bond is charged as a misdemeanor, which would mean the maximum penalty that you face is 9 months in jail, or as a Class H felony, which in Wisconsin would mean that you face up to 6 years of total incarceration and supervision as a result. Rather than tying it to the seriousness of what you allegedly did, we tie it to what you are on bond for. So in other words, if you are charged with felony theft, any violation of any condition of your bond would be a new felony offense. And if you're on bond for misdemeanor battery, any violation of your bond would be a new misdemeanor offense.
And so this could escalate the situation quite quickly in terms of what you're faced with if you can have multiple charges for bail jumping.
Absolutely. So someone who is on bond for a nonviolent lower-level felony offense, for example, maybe has been told not to drink and to avoid a certain bar in town and not to have contact with the individual that reported the crime. And then if he or she goes out on if he goes out on his birthday and has a beer with his friends at the bar he's not supposed to be at and happens to see the person who reported the earlier crime, that would be at least three new felonies and possibly more, in addition to the underlying charge. And it's easy to see then why it is that when bail jumping charges add up very quickly, people tend, in general, to plead guilty to the underlying offense with a district attorney often agreeing to dismiss one or more of those bail jumping charges in exchange for the guilty plea.
Oh, that's where you're seeing lawmakers say, hey, this is forcing plea deals?
That's right. It gives prosecutors a lot of leverage in plea negotiations because bail jumping charges usually are pretty easy to prove, right? They came to someone's attention in the first place. That evidence usually establishes that, in fact, there has been a violation of bond. And the penalties are just very, very high, often for behavior that may seem fairly minor. Now, it's also important to notice, though, that bail jumping can be quite serious. If you have a restraining order against you for domestic violence, and then you go and seek out your girlfriend, who is the victim of that domestic violence, most people would consider that a pretty significant infraction. So the ability to bring bail jumping charges isn't simply used frivolously. It can be used for good reasons, too.
We're talking with Cecilia Klingel. She's an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches courses in criminal law. We're looking at bail jumping in Wisconsin. What do you want to know about what it means to jump bail? Do you know someone who has been charged with jumping bail? How did that affect their underlying case? Your questions, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Cecilia, how are Wisconsin's approach to bail jumping charges, does that contrast to other states?
So in many states, bail jumping as a criminal charge is reserved for cases in which someone on bond fails to show up in court. The whole idea behind bail historically has been that whether you're paying money or agreeing to follow rules, we're doing that to make sure you show up to your court cases. Because after all, as I said at the beginning, the presumption of innocence attaches to anyone who hasn't been convicted of a crime. And so the legal system doesn't actually have a lot of power to make you follow rules and do things against your will until you've been convicted. And as a result, the focus of bail jumping usually is that failure to show up for your court case so we can decide whether or not you're guilty. In Wisconsin, because we allow it for any violation of any condition of bond, and because we allow an indefinite number of charges in any one case, depending on how many conditions someone's alleged to have violated, we end up in a situation where bail jumping is one of our most charged crimes in the state. It's also one of our most dismissed crimes in the state, which, again, I think points to the fact that very frequently bail jumping charges will be dismissed when someone pleads guilty to the underlying crime.
Yeah. How often do you see bail jumping charges dismissed, and why are they dismissed?
There are lots of reasons why it might be dismissed. And in some cases, of course, you can imagine that there was bad information and someone didn't really violate. In other cases, there may be a decision that it's not necessary, that is disproportionate, the punishment to what actually happened. But in many cases, we see those charges being dismissed at the same time that someone is pleading guilty to another crime, maybe including one or more counts of bail jumping, but usually to something substantive. Importantly, though, it's also the case in Wisconsin that you can be convicted of bail jumping even if you're acquitted of the underlying crime or those original charges are dismissed.
And so even if your penalties and those underlying charges are dropped or you're innocent of them, you could still have these lingering charges of bail jumping that have to play out in court.
That's right, because the violation of the rules of your release is seen as an independent crime from whether or not you actually committed the crime you were originally charged with and were on bail for.
Can you point to specific cases at all where you saw bail jumping charges used as leverage to reach a plea deal?
So I mostly hear about this from state public defenders or from even prosecutors who talk about the way that bail jumping is used. I, of course, am hiding in the ivory tower talking to folks on the ground, but not seeing these cases in court day to day. There have been some really good studies published, however, in the last year or two. There was a law review article several years back that did a deep dive into the data and also talked about some real cases from Wisconsin that really examined our state's specific practices. And then more recently, last year, there were several reports, I believe, put out by different think tanks around the state exploring this issue in greater depth.
Talking with UW Law School professor Cecilia Klingel. She's our guide to bail jumping when a defendant violates a condition a judge places on them when they are released before trial. What do you think about bail jumping? Should the severity of the charge be dependent on the underlying case? How do you feel about putting limits on how many bail jumping charges a defendant can get? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment, more conversation with Cecilia Klingel right here on the Ideas Network. Morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about bail jumping in Wisconsin's criminal justice system that is violating the conditions of bond. It's one of the most commonly charged crimes in our state, becoming more common. What questions do you have about the criminal justice proceedings for someone out on bail? What do you want to know about bail jumping? Still time for you at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. UW Law School's Cecilia Klingel teaches courses in constitutional criminal procedure, sentencing, and corrections, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Ben is joining us from West Salem. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I've just been listening, and it seems like there's a lot of concern, maybe perhaps I'm wrong, but on the additional charges that are being added on the bail jumping. And I'd just like to point, in my personal experience, a man was stalking a friend of mine, did some pretty terrible things. And then due to his constant interactions and stalking her and tracking her down at her home and at bars, he got more charges. But then due to some type of evidence situation, his original charge was dropped, but he's now incarcerated, rightfully so, because of the extra bail jumping charges that they were able to get stuck on him. And I just wanted to make that point and, you know, just kind of say it's not always bad that more charges are getting on. Sometimes it really saves the public from a mistake, you know, by an officer or a court officer. And
yeah,
that's all.
Ben, thank you so much for sharing that story. Cecilia, what do you hear there about that different perspective, a look on bail jumping?
Well, so I definitely think it brings home the important point that although some rules of bond may seem unnecessary, others are important, like staying away from victims of serious crimes. At the same time, typically, if someone's engaging in problematic conduct, violating restraining orders, continuing, for example, stalking behavior, even after stalking charges have been brought, very often prosecutors are going to be able to bring new criminal charges about the substance of that behavior. Bail jumping becomes a problem in cases where the felony offense might turn on something as simple as having a drink on your birthday when your underlying crime has no connection whatsoever to alcohol consumption. In other words, it's the restraining of the liberty of people who haven't been convicted of a crime yet in ways that are questionable that then lead to very serious charges against them that I think has become a real point of concern, not bringing charges against someone who's engaging really in continued criminal behavior.
Ben, thanks for calling. Let's now bring in Cindy in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Well, I'd just like to say that I think bail is actually part of a class warfare because people of color and poor people very rarely can post bail or even offered bail. I mean, you've heard stories of people who sat in prison for 2 or 3 years before their case was even heard because they didn't have the affordability to post bail. So I think it's a class warfare issue, and I just think it needs to be a more fair and just system.
So Cindy brings up bail practices being inequitable. Cecilia?
Well, there's certainly no doubt that the poor are more likely to be incarcerated pretrial than are people who are more affluent. And we also know that being incarcerated pretrial has a lot of negative effects on how cases end. People who are incarcerated pretrial are more likely to plead guilty to crimes than people who are not. They're more likely to face longer sentences than people who are not. So it's a really important decision that the system has to make. And there are a lot of concerns about the equity of requiring even what may seem to a judge like a modest amount of cash bond may seem to an impoverished person like an impossible amount. I would point out our state actually does better than a lot of states on this front because we don't have a privatized bail bond industry. In general, our courts keep cash bond levels much lower than you might see in other states. And many of our judges are accustomed to letting people be released on with a signature rather than with cash bond. But that doesn't mean that we don't have a problem. I do think it's important for us as folks in our state, as in other states across the country, talk about what's often called bail reform, trying to get more people pretrial out the door of the jail and back into the community. We do need to think about the effect of releasing people with lots of conditions, because given our state's laws, when we release people, but we place lots and lots of conditions on that release instead of asking them for money, then we are setting them up in many cases for the potential of future bail jumping charges.
We've seen Representative David Crowley of Milwaukee and State Senator LaTanya Johnson both proposing legislation for practices around bail jumping. What kind of change do these lawmakers want to see?
So fundamentally, they want to do two things. One would be to limit the ability to bring bail jumping charges for reasons other than non-appearance in court, which would be similar to, again, the practice of a lot of different states. And second would be to cap that penalty at the misdemeanor level, to say that bail jumping might be a crime in some cases, but that crime is going to be a misdemeanor, not a new felony.
We're talking with Cecilia Klingel, an associate professor at the UW Law School. We're looking at bail jumping, one of the most commonly charged crimes in our state. We heard from Elma in Madison, who couldn't stay with us, and Elma wanted to know if there's more bail jumping because people are not getting access to a speedy trial.
So I think that that's an interesting question. It seems to me that speedy trials, or the lack thereof, extend the amount of time that someone is going to be on bond.
And if they have an extended time that they have to meet these parameters set by the judge, that could perhaps cause them to slip up, maybe, you know, not appear in court.
Whether it causes it or not is an interesting question, but it certainly increases the amount of time they have to make a mistake, right? And for many people, again, especially as we talk about cases in which there are lots and lots of conditions, ones that may be difficult for people to comply with. So, for example, if I am required to participate in drug testing or not consume alcohol, and I have a substance abuse problem, and I'm not getting treatment for that problem, it's going to be very difficult for me to comply with those bond conditions. And the longer I'm on bond, the more likely it's going to be that I'm going to be detected failing to meet that expectation.
You mentioned earlier there about bail jumping reform practices. What are you seeing out there in terms of how states are addressing their laws, changing them in terms of bail jumping?
So what we're mostly seeing is bail reform more than bail jumping reform.
Okay.
Because, again, in many states, bail jumping is much less of an issue than it is here in Wisconsin. If bail jumping is a crime only attaches to people not showing up in court, you're just not going to be charging that crime very often. And most people seem to think that it's fair to bring bail jumping charges if, in fact, you are not appearing in your underlying case. Bail reform more broadly is about trying to increase the ability of people, particularly poor people, to be released before they're convicted. And so in many places, the rules are changing to make it more difficult for judges to impose high amounts of cash bail or even any cash bail in some cases, and also to limit the situations in which judges can keep someone detained pre-trial with the allegation that it would be too dangerous to release that person.
Well, Cecilia, thank you so much for joining us.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches courses in criminal law, constitutional criminal procedure, policing, sentencing, corrections. Just ahead, we speak with an associate professor of psychology at Northwestern about how white parents aware of racial bias are more likely to talk with their kids about race. We look at new research on child development, social cues, and emerging science on racial bias. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.